Hey, Anna, you're a young person, right?
Totally.
I mean, I don't know, but can you remember before digital photography? Can you remember the time before we, you know, took pictures with our phones and...
I want to say no to go with the young person thing, but I totally remember Polaroids and actual cameras and getting film developed and stuff.
Well, back in my day... We used to take pictures out of a can, and and we go to the drugstore.
We would just draw things.
That's right, just draw things. Well, so in the old days, even before me, astronomers had their own kind of photography too, where they would attach gigantic cameras to their telescopes, or the cameras were giant telescopes, and they take their pictures on giant glass plates, like that are 8x10 pieces of glass,
Dang.
And capture pictures of the sky that way.
Wow.
And I actually went on all the way into the 90s that people were doing that way.
The 1990s?
Okay. That's right.
Like,
exactly.
Just wanted to double check.
And so it's only this digital technology that came along recently that we all know and love to use with our phones
oh,
and
yeah.
everything like that. So now you can put your phone right up to the eyepiece and take a picture, whereas the old astronomer 100 years ago would have to waste hours of time putting one little picture on a glass plate. That might not have even worked.
Man.
I know. Technology's grand, isn't it?
It's so grand.
From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, this is Looking Up, and I'm Dean Regas.
Talking with author Dava Sobel about her latest book, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. So we're going to talk to Dava Sobel today about her book.
Oh, yeah. Very exciting. And, I mean, it's called The Glass Universe.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be a little reference to the way that we took pictures, like I was saying, on mm-hmm. glass plates. So I brought in some glass plates we have.
Ooh.
The observatory.
Are these fragile?
They are very fragile. And I know.
I'll just look from over here.
I know you guys are listening. And so you have to enjoy our great visual description that we're going to make of these plates. So the observatory.
But we're going to put them on our Facebook.
Oh, yeah. So it'll be on our Facebook page. We'll have some pictures of our glass plates
that
we've gotten. And so when I came to the observatory, they had found about 1,200 glass plates.
Oh my
gosh. These 1,200 beautiful pictures of astronomical images of observatory directors and their families on vacations. It was really weird.
Wait a minute. Okay, you said that.
Yes.
Wait, what?
Oh, yeah.
On vacation?
On vacation. So instead of having your pictures on your phone, they had this giant box of 50 glass plates. Like, here's grandma at the beach. Here's so-and-so at San Francisco during the earthquake. I mean, I'm serious. We actually have one of those.
What? Are you
during
serious?
The earthquake in 1906, we have all these earthquakes.
Not the most portable.
Slots. But okay. Anyway, let's get to happy thoughts.
Sorry, yes.
And this is the astronomical images that we have.
Uh-huh.
Most of them are very small glass plates, like about 3 inches by 5 inches. But I brought in two of the big ones.
Ooh.
So these are like 8.5 inch, eight and a half by 11 inch, or 8x10 or something like that. Anyway, I can't measure it.
It's fine.
So the one I'm looking at now, this is a picture taken of the total eclipse of the sun, May 29th, 1919, showing the corona, prominences, and stars photographed
Ooh.
By British astronomers in Brazil. Check that out.
That's very cool.
And so it looks just like the pictures of the eclipse we got just this last
More
summer.
More or less, yep. Mm-hmm.
But this is how we recorded this stuff. And it's just the detail on it is really pretty amazing.
Actually, I just see on the bottom left hand. Yeah, it's...
So you get that black hole look, like the whole moon is blocking out the whole sun. You see the corona around the sun and a prominence. And just to think this is almost 100 years old... And it was just laying in our attic. It was really cool. Which one do you got?
I don't know. You're going to have to tell me.
Oh, you are holding it.
This is like a...
How does it look?
It looks like a shooting star.
Very close. Yeah, that's a comet. That's Halley's Comet.
So, ooh, when was that last around?
Well, last was 1986, but this one was taken in 1910. So that was Halley's Comet when it came by 117 years ago. And so... For astronomers, this was huge that they could actually take pictures and have this as a physical record. Because I know you were joking that how they did stuff before is they drew.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we did up until about that time.
Okay, don't say we like you were there with a pencil in your hand. I mean, you're not that old.
That's true.
And I'll give you that.
That's true. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I use the glass plates. No. But that was one of the debates we had at the Cincinnati Observatory was, should we use cameras or not? Mm-hmm. And part of the thing was some of astronomers, the old-fashioned ones, they thought it was cheating. They said,
oh,
I've been drawing since I was, you know, 2 years old, so I'm not going to start using these fancy new cameras.
And take like a 5-pound like glass plate picture. That's cool.
Well, that was the other thing, is to take this picture is so much work. You had to spend hours and hours and hours, and maybe you didn't even get a picture when you're all done. Whereas somebody with a pen and paper and pencil just draw it, like, look, comet, I drew it.
Unless they get tired of drawing.
That's right.
That's true. They are cool to think about that this is an actual image, you know, captured.
Yeah, and I think Dava is going to talk about a little bit of storage problems, because they had so many plates at Harvard that they had to build whole buildings just hold all these glass plates and all these pictures.
Yeah, and folks should definitely head to our Facebook, because we're going to post these so they can see what the heck we've been talking about.
Yeah, I don't think we describe them very...
They're like, it's a comet and a sun, an eclipse.
Yeah.
That's very cool. And I also thought, though, maybe, and I don't want to get too, you know... reading into this too much, but maybe that the glass universe referred to the glass ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these women were kind of like pioneers, really, in astronomy and in their work. And I mean, that could be like a thing too much. I'm reading into it.
No, I think that's exactly right. I think because it was a little tough for women to get into astronomy. It was a men's field, and I think Dave is going to be telling a lot of anecdotes about that. I'm sure it's. Because really at the Cincinnati Observatory, we had women roles. Their roles were computers.
Yeah.
And they were computing all of the data that the astronomers were collecting. And so I know we think of computers as objects.
Something I hold in my hand at this point.
Exactly.
I mean, my phone.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
But a lot of the computing fell to female astronomers that would crunch all these numbers, all this data from asteroids that they were discovering and stars and all this stuff. It was that was the big role about 100 years ago.
That's crazy. I also like that last year we No Theater put on a play called Silent Sky about some of these women that worked at the Harvard Observatory and how their role evolved from being computers and just, you know, into really more the practice and research and being more involved. So this is kind of a cool follow-up to that.
Was that the debut for that Silent Sky, or had it been around a little bit?
I'm not sure. It's a good question. I just know that they did a run of it here, and I think it had been done in other places, but it was just a really very timely and cool. And then also the release of Hidden Figures, which is my favorite movie of all time.
Really?
Like, if I'm feeling down, I like watch that movie, because I think it's inspiring. I really found those women to be really incredible. And I just, I don't know. I think that the whole role of women in astronomy, and just to see how it kind of began, and then to see more and more women in the field, is, I think, really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it really is startling, the obstacles that they had to overcome.
It is.
What were there some specific things in either that play, Silent Sky, or the movie, that what kind of struck you the most?
I think that what it is that the assumption was that the women were only able to physically, like, just transcribe or add numbers, to only be in this sort of essentially, you know, a machine, which now we rely on a machine to do these things. But what really it turned out, especially in Hidden Figures a lot and in Silent Sky, is that they were real, I mean, some mathematical geniuses in some cases, that had a real, aptitude, as well as, you know, an interest and a curiosity, and they were able to discover some really cool things. And I think that's what's really interesting, is that just because you were put in this one role, maybe because it was needed to be done, I thought it was just cool that they really had some real skills.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to get to that point, they knew a lot. I mean, their computing that they were doing, I mean, I don't think I could do it. The stuff that they were doing, don't answer that so quick.
I was going to be like, I don't think so either, I didn't mean me. I meant
not
you.
Not even close.
There is no way.
I couldn't hold their slide rule. That's for sure. They had to know quite a bit to get to that role. But there was this level that they couldn't go past.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the thing. I mean, there was one story that, female astronomers couldn't be under the dome because it was too cold and it was too strenuous. And
please,
I mean
women bear children for God's sake. I'm just saying, but it's too. Oh, it's a little too chilly
cold.
In the dome. Come
I,
on.
I know. After a long night working at the observatory, I'm like totally spent. I mean, it's not that exhausting. What's going on in there?
I don't know. Yeah,
sounds like an excuse to me.
Sounds like a huge excuse.
Yeah, exactly.
We've just blown it wide open.
That was it. Yep.
So I think it's exciting, too, that we see not only on the sort of national stage of NASA and different, you know, organizations where women are so much more involved and have these prominent roles, but, you know, our own volunteers, we have a lot more women, I feel like, that are involved, that are incredibly, I mean, they're amazing in what they're able to do. And then that we see little girls that come through, and maybe they're going to be like the next generation.
Yeah, I think a lot of those barriers are really down. I mean, we've got so many folks doing missions and, you know, NASA missions and engineering. And there's so many different fields that that women can go into now that is just like, it's just amazing. And then our volunteers at the observatory are, we've had a lot of stories of folks that started as high school students and are now in the sciences and college. And that always just makes me feel really great.
Oh, yeah. Very exciting.
So there's a new book out about a group of unheralded women scientists known as the Human Computers at the Harvard College Observatory. And they were there in the 1800s and 1900s. They're a focus of this book from my friend Dava Sobel called The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And I'm so happy to have Dava join us today. Well, Dava, thanks so much for talking with me today. I'm really excited to talk about your new book, Glass Universe. But I do have to ask, since we met at the total solar eclipse about 11 years ago, how was your eclipse experience in August?
It was too good.
Too good? How could it be too good?
It was too good because the weather was so perfect that there was no drama. Usually there are clouds and everybody's worried a little bit, and then you see it and you feel great. But here it was a cloudless sky. There was no doubt that we were all going to see it, and I missed that.
You miss the drama? I love that there was no drama. I liked not having to worry. I'd be like, I kick back, relaxed, because I'm a nervous wreck during eclipses.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right. Well, then I'm not going to go to an eclipse with you then, because I like to be relaxed.
Okay. Well, were you relaxed this time? How was it?
No, I still wasn't relaxed, even though it was completely clear. I didn't relax till about 10 minutes before. I ended up being in Franklin, Kentucky, and there were no clouds. But by the time it started, then I was relaxed. That's about it. Hooting and hollering and all that stuff.
Okay.
Your new book, Glass Universe, this is, when I read this, I thought you set the tone really well in the beginning, talking about solar eclipses. You give this anecdote from the total solar eclipse at 1878, where the astronomers are out watching this eclipse, and the men astronomers were outside, but a female astronomer assistant was inside. Was that a true story where she had to stay inside to count the time and not see the eclipse?
Right, because as you can understand, having seen a couple, it's a very distracting sight, and the person would not pay attention to a job such as counting seconds when seeing that spectacle for the first time. So she volunteered.
Oh, she volunteered. So this is Anna Draper, is that correct?
Anna Palmer Draper, right.
And so her husband is outside watching the eclipse and noting it, and she's inside the tent counting time. But she never got to see the eclipse.
She did not. She didn't see one until 1900.
Oh, wow.
She actually observed.
That was the most tragic thing that I read about. And it just kind of set the tone. Cause
that was phase one, Dean.
But it kind of set the tone for the book, is like, so that there's these, the roles for the men are this and the roles for the women are something else. And that made it so sad to me, I thought.
Yeah, but the women really got to do some great things. Mrs. Draper did not work at the Harvard Observatory, but she provided a lot of the funding to hire other women. She was independently wealthy.
Well, and so... Yeah, and that leads us to Edward Pickering. And so he was at Harvard, and he had all this I guess astronomical work that needed to be done. And so who did he hire?
He liked to hire women, as he'd already seen that they could do the work, and being a practical man, knew that for the price of one man, he could get two or even three women.
And but these were pretty accomplished women. I mean, they had they were up to the task, that's for sure.
They certainly were.
So there's one character in your book that that really kind of stuck out to me, and that was Wilhelmina Fleming. Tell us the story behind her.
She was a Scottish immigrant. She had been a school teacher in Scotland, and she came here with her husband as a young bride, and then he disappeared on her, and she found herself alone and pregnant and understandably desperate. So she took a job in the residence side of the observatory as a domestic servant. And the Pickerings recognized her intelligence and moved her into the observatory and taught her how to do calculations and how to study these glass plates, photographs of the night sky to make discoveries. And then they helped her go home to Scotland to have her baby with her mother and grandmother present. And she was so grateful to them, she named her baby Edward Charles Pickering Fleming.
Oh, wow.
And he had promised her a real job if she would come back. So when the boy was about 2 years old, she did returned to Cambridge, and she spent the rest of her life working at Harvard and really distinguished herself. She became the first woman to hold any sort of Harvard University title. She was the curator of astronomical photographs.
And and so she was in part of the core group of the computers, the folks that were working on these glass plate slides, right?
Right, and they were called computers because at the beginning, they really did compute. But once they had these photographs, their jobs changed because they were making real discoveries. And Pickering used to say that a person could discover more things looking at one of these images through a magnifying glass than could be found looking through a telescope at the sky during the night.
So this was a chance for the camera to really shine. You know, this is kind of a new technology, putting the camera and taking photographs of the sky.
Right. It was new, and many people thought it was gimmickry and that it would never last. We can laugh at that today. Astrophotography is certainly a mainstay of astronomy. But this was the very beginning of it. And Pickering was a physicist. He was trained as a physicist and had taught physics at MIT. And he was really interested in the physics of the stars at a time when most professional astronomers were just working on positions of the stars and orbits of comets and asteroids. It was the very dawn of astrophysics.
And so we're talking about your new book, Glass Universe, and it's not only about these female astronomers and computers, but there's a big part to play for the wealthy patrons. It seems like that Pickering and some of the astronomers there they're almost dependent on these female patrons of the sciences to help them with their funding.
Yes, the observatory got no money from the university, so it really had to raise its own funds. And Pickering was fortunately very charming and was able to bring in thousands of dollars. He, through Mrs. Draper, he tripled the operating budget of the observatory at a stroke. And she kept up her level of support for 30 years. So it was tremendously important. And he was able to attract another wealthy woman, Catherine Wolfe Bruce, who was happy to write him a check for $50,000. This was in 1890.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
To build a very large telescope specifically designed for photography to be used in the southern hemisphere so he could really cover the entire sky.
Well, and did that lead to some kind of debates between the astronomers who were taking the pictures and taking these glass plates and then shipping them back to Harvard, and then the female computers and the astronomers that were there? That who was the discoverer of the object? So if an astronomer took a picture, was the photographer the discoverer, or was the person that was analyzing the plates the discoverer?
Well, that became an issue. So certainly the photographer, the astrophotographer, wanted to look at the plate to see if there was something really stunning, maybe a new nova. And, of course, the women back at Harvard wanted to be doing that. So it was shared. The astronomers looked over their work on site, but then the really careful study went on back at Harvard. Even now, it can safely be said that the information content of those 500,000 glass plates, which are still at Harvard, the content has not been fully probed because there's just too much there.
Well, yeah, so they still have hundreds of thousands of them, or did you say 500,000 plates?
500,000, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And in the last chapter of your book, you mentioned the near disaster that happened. I mean, here these plates have been around for 100 years or more, and there was a flood, essentially, at the storage facility. What all happened?
Well, about 60,000 of the plates were submerged in muddy water, and the custom-built scanning and digitization equipment, which was down in the basement there as part of a National Science Foundation project to digitize most of these plates, that also was a victim of the flood. But fortunately, volunteers came and carried all the plates outside, and nothing got broken. And they were all sent to a preservation facility where they are being cleaned and returned, and most of them look fine. And the insurance money paid to rebuild the scanning and digitization equipment. So that process is back in progress. And because the new equipment is faster, they will catch up with themselves.
So they still haven't all been scanned yet?
No.
Wow.
No.
That's so, I mean, well, think 500,000 glass plates in storage. Wow. That's an incredible, just a great collection of, well, it's history. It's history of astronomy right there.
It is. It's a unique resource.
Well, David, this has been great talking with you about all this. I know you're also well known for your books, Galileo's Daughter, Planets, and Longitude. I do have to ask, do you have anything in the works? What's coming next?
I don't know. I don't have another idea yet.
No ideas?
No.
Oh,
no.
Well, I will have to collaborate. That would be a good week. I can come
there
up with some ideas.
That would be fun.
That would be fun to work with you on a project.
I bet we'd have a great time.
Oh, yeah. Well, this has been great. We really appreciate you talking to us about the glass universe, and hopefully we'll see you in Cincinnati sometime soon.
I look forward to it.
Thank you, Dava.
Well, the Cincinnati Observatory has been around since the mid-1800s, so you can only imagine the many letters we've received in that time, and phone calls, I guess, in this case.
Yes.
With some very interesting questions or beliefs or concerns or theories, I guess I'll say. So we like to highlight those in the crank file here on Looking Up. So, Dean, you have one that's recent.
We have a new crank file for the archives, and this one just came in just this week.
Mm-hmm.
It was a question about taking pictures of the night sky with your camera phone.
So timely, actually. And this
exactly.
is I will exactly. back. This is legit. To just
this is weird. I mean, the call that came in said, you know, I saw some things, and I need them explained, and call me back right away.
Right.
So whenever I hear that, I think I'll call him back next week. And but, this time I called back a little sooner. And so I because I've heard this story so many times. Well, so the story is he took a picture mm-hmm. of the dark outside. He was taking a picture of the outside sky or the ground. Well, he took lots of pictures of the ground. Anyway, it was the pictures at night.
Okay.
And in those pictures, there were ghostly images that were processed. So it looked like there were ghosts.
Now, did he take it with like a phone?
Yes.
Yes,
that's the first question I asked. What did you use? And it was like a Samsung Galaxy or something like that. Or
how appropriate.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Oh, that's nice. And so there's these ghostly images that appeared. And so he was really concerned that either A, they were ghosts, mm-hmm. or B, when he hauled them up and tried to take a picture of the sky, they were in the sky. And so maybe they were aliens. Now, the problem is that, yeah, and the question I always ask is, so did you see them with your eyes? And
yeah.
they said, no, they only appeared on the camera. And so this is a very common thing is that, you know, when you're trying to take a picture of the night sky and it's very dark conditions, your camera is not equipped to do those kind of pictures. Mm-hmm. It can't resolve that kind of fine lighting. You can't take pictures of the stars just by holding it up to the sky and taking a picture.
Mm-hmm.
But your camera is struggling and it's trying to like make sense of what it's seeing. And so it picks up these either ghostly images, either reflections of light behind you mm-hmm. or something going in the chips that could do this, or there could be damaged chips in there that you get.
Oh.
And so it's completely an artifact of the camera. However, people get super convinced. And so
he was not super convinced
by my answer.
Not by you. In fact, at one point, I think, because I was there when you were talking to him, so I have to like add a little bit. At one point, you did say you should be more trusting of me. It's like I'm not working for the government or something crazy like
that's
that.
Right. Yeah, he was very skeptical of me, but yet he was not skeptical of like his friends that he showed it to, and you know, and a priest,
mm-hmm.
and the priest said that you know he showed it to this priest friend, and the priest was like, "We're gonna have to go over and do an exorcism, that's for sure." I mean, so the priest was convinced. So that's when I said, "Maybe you need to be more skeptical of your priest." And more trusting of your astronomer. And so this is the thing. So if anybody wants to take a picture of a ghost, quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
Take your phone out, hold up to the sky, take a picture, and you will get a picture of a ghost.
But and then call Dean at 321.
No.
Oh, sorry.
Don't give my phone number. Don't give my home number.
I'll put it on the website.
That's right.
This is getting...
But yeah, try it out because you'll most likely get a ghostly image. And it's, unfortunately, it's not a real ghost. Or actually, maybe it is fortunate.
Well,
otherwise.
Well, yeah, it can be. Well, this guy did not want it to be a ghost, I don't think.
Yeah.
That was.
Ooh. Don't want it to be that. That's for sure. So, and it wasn't an alien. It was all in your camera. But yeah, definitely try it out. See what you come up with.
Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to author Davis Sobel for being our special guest. Get in touch with us. Like and comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/lookingupwvxu. And we're also on Twitter at Looking Up Podcast, or you can drop us a note at lookingup@wvxu.org.
We always like to get some questions, so send those over to us, or a topic suggestion, or ask your kids what they'd like to ask an astronomer or scientist, and we'll try to answer those on future episodes.
And remember to subscribe to Looking Up on iTunes, and please take a moment to rate or comment on us there, or on Stitcher. You can also catch the show at wvxu.org/lookingup. Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y ? From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provided additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.